Hi, and welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
Kelsey, the day is finally here.
It is finally here. You and I have talked about this. We planned for it before we even knew what the podcast was going to be.
Yep.
And it happened, and it was delightful.
Yes. And we're talking about the episode title, which is our interview with Julia and Long, or maybe we titled the episode slightly something different, but her name will be in there. So yeah, it was, you know, we started this podcast off with Penny Braille Green. And like Kelsey said, when we were brainstorming, we were like, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be amazing if we could actually talk to the author after we got through our series? And, you know, we've talked to a few authors between now and then, but Julie Ann Long has been such a just kind supporter of somebody, you know, dissecting their works and throughout all of this. And so like, it's just, it was so amazing to get to talk to her for so many reasons.
Yes, it was. I mean, from the moment we announced the podcast saying that we were going to be starting with one of her books, she was like, oh, I'm so flattered. And she really promoted us and has even mentioned us in other posts where they talk about podcasts. She's like, recently I saw, she's like, oh, I love this one podcast. It's called At Tea and Strumpets. And I'm like, you're just like shouting us out because you like us? Oh my gosh, it's so great.
I think it was also just like a really warm welcome to Romance Landia. Like both of us were so not in the book scene because we were really just passive readers. We weren't like on Bookstagram or anything like that. Like that wasn't a term that I knew. So anyhow, we have a lot to thank her for as readers and also as podcasters. And I think just as human beings, we've learned a lesson or two from her books as well.
I think we have. So without further ado, let's get into our interview with Julie Ann Long. So today we are so excited to be joined by the author who wrote the books covered in our first three episodes, has been a fan and supporter since day one, the woman who got Zoe into romance, Julie Ann Long.
Whoa, I did that? That's awesome.
Yeah.
So nice to join you guys finally. I adore your podcast and I'm so beyond thrilled and touched that you enjoy Penny Royal Green so much. It's just like, oh, my heart. You know?
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, absolutely. We love it, obviously. We've talked about it so much and we're just so flattered, all the things that you just said. But yeah, it was my first romance book. Kelsey gave it to me. That's how this whole thing got started. So it just feels like, you know, we're coming full circle. It's really exciting to talk to you.
It's nice to have that opportunity. I can't believe I was your gateway drug to romance. Boy.
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm going to put that on my resume for sure. Gateway drug author.
Well, on that, we like to break the ice with our toughest question so that everything is easier from here. So, Julie, are you ready?
Oh, gosh. Bring it on.
So, our first question is, do you have a favorite romance novel?
You know what? No. I mean, because I don't have a single romance novel. When I like an author or love an author, I tend to love their whole body of work. You know what I mean? It's like, it's more about a voice. But so I never isolated by like a single book. But, you know, I love Loretta Chase. I love Grace Burroughs. I love Julia Quinn. I love them for different reasons. And maybe because I'm a writer, I get slightly different things out of it than a reader would. Or I'm looking for slightly something different. But I can tell you some of the first books that launched me into it. And those were books like, I kind of wanted to mention those, like The Thornbirds, or there's a book in the 80s that everybody read. It was a huge book called Through a Glass Darkly. And when I read, it was a big, do you guys know that book?
No.
Oh, you've not heard of that one. It's a big sweeping romance set in like the 16th, 17th century. And I wanted to write a book like that. When I set out to write The Runaway Duke, I wanted to write a book that was sort of panoramic and had many points of view, and it was luscious and sexy. And so those were the kinds of my inspirations, you know? So when I think about the books that I love the best, it's the books that set me out on this path. And I would have to go to like Rosemary Rogers too, who I found in my mom's nightstand drawer and got, and my sister and I stole her books out of my mom's nightstand drawer. You know, those were influential. Do you guys ever read those?
I haven't. Kelsey, have you read any?
No, I'm intrigued. One of our favorite things about these conversations is hearing about the inspiration for authors that we admire, because then it's like, cool, let's add these to the list.
I know. I think a lot of authors you talk to will probably go back to those. And it also depends. It was what my mom had. And that was, you know, and if she's hiding it from us, surely it was a good thing. You know, we had to have look at and see what was in it. So it's that kind of thing. And other books, like there was another one that was also hidden from me and my sister, Forever Amber. Do you know that one? Natalie, she's Kissin' Let Me Tell You on Instagram, and the person who designed the Penny Royal Green mug. We were talking about that recently because that was also a big, sexy, kind of controversial book back in the, when was it published, the 40s? Really, really hot stuff for that. Oh, wow. But when you ask me that question, I'm like, I hesitate to isolate one, but because there are so many. But I wanted to give a shout out to those, because those are sort of the origin story of me.
Well, that's really fantastic, because you answered our second question too with your first one, which is, we wanted to know a little bit about your history with romance. And it sounds like you got into it from your mom's nightstand. Is that the origin story?
That's pretty much it. It was Rosemary Rogers and Laurie McBain, Kathleen Woodiwiss. Then later, Catherine Coulter. I remember when I discovered Amanda Quick, and then I gobbled those like M&Ms, I tell you, when I found those. I'm like, oh, she has so many. There was a used bookstore a couple blocks away from my house in San Francisco, and I cleaned out their section of those books. But Julia Quinn, I remember finding those. I remember I had a moment when I went to a Barnes, it was the Borders on Union Square in San Francisco, and they had a beautiful display of Romancing Mr. Bridgerton. And I'm like, that's what I want to do. I want to do that.
That's fabulous. And I love the secondhand bookstore. A lot of the first reads when I started reading romance was my friend got them from her mom. She shared them with her daughter. My friend didn't have to steal them. But then there was Half Price Books, which was the best part, was just going to Half Price Books and, you know, setting yourself a budget for the day. And my friend would just mail me just a bunch of books she got at Half Price Books and be like, here, read these.
Oh, the best care packages. Yeah. You know, used bookstores, they all set it. They all established the habit. So thank God for them.
And so, Julie, have you always wanted to be an author, or what was the journey from reader to author? I know you said you saw a book, you know, of Julia Quinn's, and you knew you wanted to do that, but I feel like there's maybe a few things more in between.
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding like you can see me, but I'm like, yeah. But yeah, pretty much. I mean, that seemed the whole point of learning how to write when I was little, was so I could tell stories. And because I wanted to... It was just delicious. It seemed the ability to create a whole world, you know, from scratch was, I couldn't imagine anything better. And so I started to write little stories the minute I learned how to write. And I think the first one was an illustrated story about a talking rabbit. you know, it had, you know, bound with staples. I delivered it to the neighbors, several copies of it. And then... I used to sit by the bookcase in our living room, and there are all the grown-up books, you know, the ones with no pictures and that were nice and thick. And when I was like 3 or 4, and I'd pull them out and I'd just look at the blocks of words and try to invent stories for them, pretending I knew how to read. So yeah, there were some side trips into various other ventures, like I played music and stuff for a long time, but it all sort of circles back to writing and words. And I mean, even songwriting is related to telling a story with words.
Mm-hmm. So then what made you want to write in this time period? So you're pretty much in the Regency time period, Regency, late Regency, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Regency is 9 years. It,
yeah. Yeah. Well, it's after George is king. He's king now. So it's, I mean, 1820 is pretty much when Pretty Moral Green is set. And likewise, the Palace of mm-hmm. Rogue series. I think it was just that my favorite books that I was reading, you know, I took so much pleasure in reading books set in that time period that I wanted to emulate it, to be in it, to continue to create it, I guess, you know? I mean, we all fall in love with Jane Austen, so that was part of it. But it was also just reading the other ones that I enjoyed so much in that time period. And I'd learned a lot by osmosis. And so it seemed like, well, I can get this done faster and have the gratification of doing it faster if I write something I already pretty much, that I know a good deal about. There's, you know, you never know everything mm-hmm. about it, but I think that was probably it. And I think we get, like I've said, I like to say is that we can blame Jane Austen for all of that. Cause like if she wrote Inca romances, we'd all be reading, you know, romances set in the Inca era. It was just her voice and her view of the world was so distinctive and ripples to this day.
I feel like if there were Inca romances, there would just be a lot of scenes on steps, you know?
Don't tempt me. I'll have to, we'll do Inca fan fiction.
Oh, it's a beautiful, beautiful place. I mean, it's very romantic if you ever have the chance to get, you know, to that part of the world. But we had a couple of questions from listeners for you that actually kind of have already been answered a little bit in what you said. But one of our listeners said, what authors, historical romance or otherwise, inspire you as a writer? And I know you've mentioned a couple, but I just wanted to see if there were any more that you wanted to respond with for that question.
It's a different question. Inspire me as a writer. And you know, when I'm writing romance, I make it almost a point not to read it or not to read as much of it because mm-hmm. I don't want to pick up anyone else's accent. You know what I mean? Like a voice. And also it keeps me fresher.
Yeah.
Like when I was, an analogy that I find useful mm-hmm. is like when I used to play in bands, I would hear songs on the radio and instead of hearing them or experiencing them as a whole, like getting lost in them, I'd listen to the bass line. I'm like, oh, why did they bury the vocal in the mix? Or, you know, why is it like that? So I couldn't experience it as a whole. And that's kind of what reading romance is or historical romance is like for me now. It feels like homework. Like, I'm like, oh, that's what she's doing here. Oh, that, you know what I mean? So in order to stay fresh mm-hmm. and inspired, it is really hard not to read. I always look for a love story. You know what I mean? Like, and I think I tend mm-hmm. to read or listen to, like Ellie Griffiths writes a series that's about an archaeologist who works with a policeman. Do you know her series?
Mm-mm. No.
But there's a love story that's a thread through it that's very angsty. And it's that kind of thing because I'm always searching for that component. But I need to read something a little bit different mm-hmm. than what I'm mm-hmm. writing. Otherwise, I just can't.
Yeah.
I've learned that about myself. I just can't. I feel like my duty to my readers is to be as creative and fresh as possible. And that's the best way I could do it. So the authors I admire and I read their books, but not while I'm working. And I think there's some, I love Loretta Chase's voice. I love, and they're all for different reasons, you know, or Grace Burroughs, I feel like writes very sophisticated, emotionally sophisticated books and I love that kind of approach. And I love the more lighthearted mm-hmm. ones too. Like I love Julia Quinn's books, you know, who doesn't?
I feel like, I don't know how you feel, Kelsey, but I definitely relate to that just as, first of all, like doing the podcast, you know, when you start reading the books or you're talking very detailed about a book, you start seeing them differently, you know, rather than just reading for the enjoyment, which can be difficult. So sometimes you have to like try to turn off your brain and say like, no, this is just for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can be tricky, isn't it?
for me, it's the opposite. I want to think critically about the book and then I get sucked into the story. And then the next thing perfect. I haven't highlighted anything. I haven't taken any notes. And I'm like, oh, I've just been enjoying this. But now I don't know what to say about it, except for it was good.
I love it. Exactly. And that's the feeling I want, you know, because that was the feeling I had when I initially started reading romance, is that, you know, you get caught up and swept away. And it's hard for me when I'm writing, which is pretty much all the time now, to get that feeling back, you know? So, but there are, again, like I say, romance adjacent, there's a lot of choices out there and a lot of fantastic authors to discover. So,
speaking of other series, we're here to talk to you a lot about our Penny Royal series.
Oh, very good. I know a little bit about it.
Which is, as I mentioned, a huge inspiration to us and our podcast. So how did you first get the idea for your Penny Royal series?
You know, I don't know why. It's like it's off in the ether, the moment I conceived it. But I knew what I wanted to do was to write a series that was kind of panoramic, like that I could, and featuring multidimensional characters. And by panoramic, I mean, I wanted to show these characters from multiple points of view. Like the pleasure in writing a connected series is being able to show, say, the hero in one book through the eyes of many other people before he gets his own book. Did I say that correctly? So I feel like it makes for a richer, more real experience. And I also thought about one of my inspirations was like a long running television series. You know, I wanted the books to be connected and to feel, have a sense of continuation. And so those were all of my impulses. Like who am I going to enjoy spending time with? What do I want to continue to write? What will be a rich source of creativity and stories? And then I thought about the Redmonds and the Everseas, and the scene with Colin going to the gallows just sort of sprang into my head. And from there, it sort of to fan out. You know, once you sit with it, it's almost funny. It's like when you zoom in on an idea and invite it to start talking to you. I mean, I know this sounds very woo-woo, but it's kind of hard to nail down a process. It's ephemeral, you know what I mean? It's very, so I sat, and then the story started to fan out from there. I began to know his brothers and sisters. I needed to know the Redmonds. You know, they just sort of, you zoom in on it and then you pan out and you could just see the story. So I don't know if that makes sense. And I also feel like sometimes when I want to be like I see Penny Royal Green, like I'm a giant standing over the town and looking down, and I can see all the stories going on as I'm writing one story. So to me, it feels like a very alive place where all kinds of things are happening at the same time. And I could move into any other story occurring simultaneously. So I wanted to make a really rich, vibrant feeling world for me and for readers.
That's super interesting. And I'm curious, did you always plan for, 11 books, or I guess 12 if you're counting Malcolm and Isabel as well, or were some added or some removed? How did that go?
I think that was kind of an organic process. You know, you start to have a feel of the momentum it took on its own momentum. And as I worked through the people that I wanted to tell stories for, a natural stopping point began to become apparent, if that makes sense. So I didn't know precisely what the number was would be, but I feel like we stopped it at probably just about the right place. I have a dozens more ideas for like prequels and, I like to call them proquels. I don't know if that's a word, but stories set in the future. But what do you think? Was that a natural stopping place? Is there a story missing? Is there a story you'd like to see? Is there?
I don't know where I got this idea from, but I had this idea that Polly, the barmaid, felt like she needed a story somewhere because she was pining for Everseas, and I felt like she needed a story somewhere. And then I thought she did have a story, but then it wasn't a story. It was just kind of Yeah. Anyway, I felt like she needed a story because she featured in so many of the books.
And that's what I mean. Like when I'm a giant, like standing over the town and I can see the stories going, I know what her story is and I know who I want to pair her with too. Mm. And that's a story I'd kind of like to write too. You know, it's hard to find all the time. Mm-hmm. And there's also, you know, cause I'd love to do that if people were interested in it, but it's also, there's like a fairly, like if creative energy is like a pool, I need to be able to, it's not an infinite pool. So I have to make sure I have the right amount of creative energy and the time at the same time, you know, to write the stories that I want to tell. So.
Oh, absolutely.
So who would you pair her with?
Oh gosh.
I know who I'd pair her with. Oh,
I wanted to pair her with one of the gypsy fella. Oh,
that's exactly. I might have mentioned this somewhere. Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to mention.
Maybe you did because I had it in my head and I was like, don't they have a book? Like they have a book. They have a novella somewhere, right? Because I was like, it's in my head.
Yeah, I know that how that story goes, but yes, that's exactly who I think that'd be a really fun story to tell.
Well, I would be here for it any day.
One day, maybe.
So did you always know Olivia and Lyon's story, like from the start, or what changed over time as the series developed and what stayed the same?
Oh, good question. No, I knew it. I knew it. I that was a thread I wanted to pull through the stories, because when you have an incident like that, where you mm-hmm. have a crushing love affair and a disappearing heir, it impacts the characters, meaning the stories and the characters in the series. You know, it's going to shape, like, for instance, you see how Violet Redmond responds to the loss of her brother. She's, you know, she's already inclined to be reckless, but now she's just like, she misses him so much that it almost doesn't matter what she does. It's just, you know, her sort of recklessness and restlessness. And a lot of that is due to the fact that the missing Lyon has changed the whole dynamic in her family. It's changed it for Miles Redmond. Mm-hmm. And it's changed everything for Olivia too. And you see some of it through the story, but you start to get a really strong sense of it, like in What I Did for a Duke, where she is, who she is, what she's presenting to the world is kind of a shell, and her family knows it. Her family knows it and resents that Lyon Redmond mm-hmm. hurt her so badly. So, yeah, I did know it, and I did want to be able to show how that impacted everybody else in the series. Even as they got their own stories, it was still the thing that gave it dimension or shaded the stories. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the background music for all of the stories in the series.
I thought you achieved that really well in the series. I thought that we grew to know Olivia and Lyon just through the little bits we saw of him, but then also just the way his memory and his presence and lack of presence changed the dynamic in his family, how that affected the Everseas in their own way as well. And so you really felt those threads through everything.
I felt too that when you got to that book, that it felt very much that you had known everything all along, that it wasn't like, oh, they had a love story, you know, and we'll figure it out when we get there, because everything falls into place so completely in that book when you learn their story and you learn the whys. And I just remember, you know, the recent time I read it, when you kind of realize how young they were and they, you know, both made mistakes, and it just like it takes these characters who I think you are kind of, as you're reading the series, you know, you're also building up some reservations about each of them. You're like, what happened? What did they do? Why? You know, I'm not sure about this and that. And then it just feels very complete and very, I think, rewarding as a reader to when you get there and get to read their story.
I am so glad you experienced that way. And sometimes it's hard. It's because both things are true, that I knew them and I didn't. And what I feel like an example that I also mm-hmm. feel is apt is like when I set out to tell a story, it's like an archaeological dig. Like I will dig up the pieces out of order. They're all there, but they're all out of order and they all need to be unearthed at certain times. And so I know that they're there, but I haven't seen it yet or examined it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I know I can, very, because the process is so, what's the word? Abstract and esoteric. It's hard to articulate it fully, but I think what your experience is, I did know it, but I didn't turn that piece over to look at it fully until the last book.
Absolutely. No, it's fascinating, but like also it just, like you say, it clicks into place.
I'm so happy you feel that way about it.
So we talked about being able to like oversee your kingdom of stories, and we really felt that with the reading of the books. So when the series did come to a close, was it hard to leave Pennyroyal Green behind, or were you ready to move on to the Palace of Rogues? Were those characters clamoring to be heard now?
Yeah, it was hard to leave it behind because I didn't feel like, and I also don't feel like I have left it behind fully. You know, it's like this universe that I've just sort of, I've walked into another room for the time being, but the universe of Pennyroyal Green exists on the other side of the room, on the other side of a door. You know, I could walk into it at any time and pull stories from it if I want to at any time. So I don't feel like it ended necessarily. And so, it did come to that natural conclusion for that story, but there are other stories that are possible from that world. So, yes and no, but I have so many ideas for so many different kinds of stories. So that I was eager to tell those too. And it's kind of fun with the Palace of Rogues series to drop in a few Easter eggs that are Pennyroyal Green-esque. I don't know, guy, if
Oh, I've exclaimed over them. Don't worry. As a reader and lover of the series, when I get those little Easter eggs, I'm like...
And so that's fun too, because they're existing simultaneously.
And that kind of is connected to a question that we did have too about Pennyroyal, though, specifically. Is there anything within the series that you're particularly proud of that like no one has asked you about, or like a hidden Easter egg or a hidden inspiration or just something that you're like, you would love to more people to be aware of?
A hidden Easter egg. Let's see.
It doesn't have to be hidden either.
You know, it's in talking to readers, what delights me the most about the books, that they all see them as very different, which was my intent, and that's kind of fun. And that they all seem to have their own little fan clubs for really charming, singular reasons, you know? And that just, they may pick up or notice something that I didn't particularly emphasize, but I'm delighted that they did it because everything I put in the books is deliberate. So it's funny because what I did for Duke comes up for a lot as a gateway, but I hear about, you know, someone else tells me how much they love Jonathan Redmond's story, for instance, you know, and how passionate they are about him, or about Ian on the balcony and, you know, Breaking Wind on the balcony, yeah. How that. So there's all of this. I don't know that there's anything that particularly that I don't think that readers are missing stuff.
That's perfect. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be an author and to have people dissect your work, you know, or the fact that we have Kindles now and people can highlight every, you know, passage and you can see, you know, how many people also have highlighted that passage. You know, that's such a, not a weird thing, but in some ways a weird thing. I say as a podcaster who talks about books. I think your answer is kind of perfect, which is that, you know, everybody sees something a little different and emphasizes so many parts of the book.
It's very personal. Yeah, it's a personal experience, and everybody has their own lens through which they read or interpret a book, and that is fun for me. I'm at this point in my life, I know that once it's out in the world, there's nothing I can do about it. It doesn't belong to me anymore, really. you know, it belongs to whoever is going to read it, experience it. I mean, and you develop that mm-hmm. sort of ability to let it go when you play music and in different crowds or, you know, or when you create art. And, but that's a part of the process that I actually love. I love to hear how people experience it. And it's not always what I want to hear, but it's all good. You know, it's all interesting to me.
Speaking of personal emphasis in books, we actually have a question from listener Laura, who's from Argentina. And she says, I feel like I should ask about your writing, but since I love the scene in What I Did for a Duke, the one in which Alex describes how being in the presence of the painting impacts Genevieve and how seeing that impacts him. And as someone who has been going to art galleries with my mom since I was a tiny, tiny child, who are your favorite artists? Which paintings, sculptures, or any other techniques are the ones that have made you feel the way Genevieve did in that scene?
Oh my goodness, there are so many. But I think John Singer Sargent is one of my very favorite. Just the the ease and emotion and color and line of his works are just floor me. And who else? Modigliani. I love his paintings of women and the beautiful long faces and the Tamara Dilempica, who did the Art Deco in that era. Her use of deep shadow and swooping lines and just big luscious blocks of color. There are almost too many. And it's a question that almost short circuits me because there are so many that I appreciate for very different reasons. And I'm learning finally to draw and to paint myself. And that's part of it. You almost want to pay tribute to that work and to the beautiful things you see around you because it's so moving. It's what music is like. It's like you almost can't accommodate that emotion. You have to turn it into something else. Can put it back out in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what art is. And that's what music is. And that's what writing is. That's a good question. I like it.
A fabulous question.
I know.
Now, you have already alluded to the fact that all the books and all the stories and all the characters can be very personal to a reader or a writer, depending on the lens that you see it through. But do you have either a character or a few characters or a book from the Penny Royale series that you kind of hold closest to your heart?
Oh, gosh. It's funny because every story was created under different circumstances and has different memories associated with it, both externally and internally for me. I think one of them, mm-hmm. and so they all, I'm fond of all of them, I say in a very egalitarian way. But, don't let the other ones hear. I think I have a soft spot for Adam Sylvain, the vicar, because it was hard, mm-hmm. not hard, but it was a challenge to write a really good guy who is innocent but not, and make him really sexy and compelling. And I think that of all the ones, he might make the best husband. You know, that so that one, I remember how challenged, how I don't like to use the word difficult because that implies some kind of resistance, you know, but it was a challenge and I wanted to get him just right. So there's that one. And also something about LaVey and Jack and Elise, and it started with a scandal. They felt like friends. Like I'd spent time with them and I felt really wistful on the day I'd finished the book because I'm like, oh, don't get to spend more time with them. You know, it was like they were, for some reason, something about that dynamic in that relationship just felt really cozy. And I wanted to be in that book for a little bit while longer. But all of them, I think. There's something I can come up with for all of them. What about you?
Oh, gosh. For me, it's Violet. I mean, I'm a Violet, so she means a lot to me. She definitely does. And I think Kelsey is going to pick the other the top contender generally,
yes.
Which is
Genevieve's book really speaks to my heart. However, that being said, upon the second reread of the series, Jonathan's book,
yep,
just we loved it from start to finish, and their story was just so beautiful, and we loved everything about it, I think, because we just seen Jonathan as the guy playing darts in the corner for so long, and to like get that depth from him and his reactions to everything and the growth that he was willing to achieve really struck a chord with us. So while Genevieve is tops, I think Jonathan is equally tops as well.
That's awesome. See, I love to, that's the kind of thing I love to hear. I also think it's one of those things that may change at different times in your life, you know, because I think that people who have been the younger brother really relate, or the younger sister really identify with Jonathan, you know, because they know what it's like to be overlooked, to be slotted, you know, to, and I mean, one of the pleasures was showing him growing up through the series to be the one who was the most, in some ways, most formidable, you know, when he was just, you know, hungover rascal in the earlier books, you know, winning all the dart tournaments. And I love, and in some people, it's funny because you hear some readers couldn't identify with Violet, but I loved her so much because she was another person who was not fully seen and not, and was kind of slotted in her family and needed to break away in order to become who she was, you know, and I needed someone like Flint to help her see, bring her truest self to the surface and to be free. So that's one of the things that I love. That's, again, what I love hearing. It's so different for everybody. And it's different, you know, you experience it based on who you are at this point in your life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, I have another probably difficult one, because I imagine after spending so many years of your life on something and, you know, as an author, I think this is probably a very personal question, but is there anything when you think back on your Penny Royal Green series that you wish you could go back and do differently?
Not really. No. Sorry. It's not that they're flawless by any means, you know, because I don't think any book is ever finished in the eyes of an author. You know, you do what you can, but it's like, now that it's a complete phenomenon, I should say, or whatever it is, a funny set of books, that I have to let it go. Mm-hmm. You know, it is what it is. So I wouldn't change what I'd done. And I think I'm, I shouldn't say I'm, I don't know that everyone is ever completely, any author is ever completely satisfied with any book, although that, you know, I can't really speak for everybody, but they are what they are. And I'm happy with them, because the emotions that the reader response is so unique and so evolving that to me, they are always a rich source of bemusement and gratitude in a way.
Yeah. And that's the reason I wanted to ask that kind of question, is because, you know, I think that it's super interesting as readers for us to hear the perspective of that from an author, because I think that readers probably all wonder that every now and then. And then sometimes when I put myself in the try to think in the mind space of what an author would think, I think, you know, exactly that at some point, like, it's out in the world and, you know, it's not just your creation anymore, because you've shared it with everyone. Just all the things you said, it's just I can't say it as well as you, as you have, so there's no reason for me to reiterate it.
I've learned over the years that to let things go. That's done. There's nothing I can do about it. Let go, move on. And so that's pretty much my philosophy towards what I write.
It sounds like a very healthy philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. It is a good philosophy.
It's an efficient philosophy. I mean, that's one of those things you have to learn through experience, that you have a limited pool of creative energy, and it doesn't serve anybody, especially you, to dwell on what's already done, what you can't do anything about. Move on.
It's only taken me like, you know, 25 years of life to understand exactly. That one.
It takes about that
long. I'm assuming I had a 5-year grace period where I didn't think too hard on my mistakes. And then the rest of my 25 years has been learning not to dwell on the past.
Yeah, you like shrug. Oh, that happened. Yep, it takes that long.
And let's note that you said learning, not practicing.
Learning, we're working on it.
Yeah. You got any other hard questions for me? These are good ones.
Oh, yes, we do. One of our listeners asks, would you rather be an Eversea or a Redmond?
Oh, are you kidding? I did a poll and it came out on Instagram and it came out pretty neck and neck. And I think, you know, here I am going to give you one of those answers again that are, you know, non-committal, but there's that oak tree, those oak trees in the center of the town that are entwined and hold each other up and can't exist without the other. And I think that's the truth. If to be in Eversea is to kind of be in Redmond, because one can't exist without the other. How's that for Zen?
I like it.
So, either or.
This is sort of related to that, because I'm sure you get this question a lot. And one of our listeners who signed as Waiting in San Francisco, they asked, will you write a prequel / sequel story about Isolde Eversea and Isaiah Redmond?
See, I do get asked that question a lot. And I have started writing that story. And I want to make sure that it's a story. I want to make sure it's a story people want to read, because, you know, to tell it properly takes it outside of the realm of what people expect in a romance. If you know, I don't want to give any spoilers if people are listening to you and they don't know. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Do I say the dreaded I word, infidelity, and to tell it properly and compassionately, I would be addressing all of those things, which sounds delicious to me, actually. Frankly, I'd love to do it. But what do you think? How do you think people would respond to it? I do get that question a lot, and I really want to know why readers want that story. I kind of get it, but I want to hear it in their words.
I think why we want to hear about it is because we see the influence of their story upon their kids and upon their actions that they take in regards to their own kids within their kids' love stories. Mm-hmm. So, and it's such a, even in that last scene where Isaiah looks up at the oak tree and sees Isolde carved in the tree, you know, from where he was waiting for her, it's just so, we get so much of that, and I think we want to know the background story behind it, because we didn't get that background story in their telling of events. You know, we kind of learned about it on the side, and it was always a peripheral. So I think, you know, as a curious reader, you want to know the whole story. I know I'm a curious reader, and I like to know all the background nitty-gritty details. I will say, Sherry Thomas wrote a very amazing prequel novel to one of her books, and I really loved it because it wasn't a romance, which was shocking when I read it because I didn't expect it. I thought that was just a book, and it was like a 1-2 series, but it wasn't. It was literally just background information on the two characters and what their childhoods were like to shape them as like adults. And so then in the actual book, you got them meeting and their story as adults. And so it was just very interesting to have all that background information before reading it, because there were so many little nuances in regards to their actions that I understood having read that earlier book versus someone who didn't read that earlier book wouldn't have gotten those details.
I think that's my only reservation, was that I think it would be specifically for readers of Pennyroyal Green. I mean, because I've seen how passionately romance readers can respond to very specific aspects of a story. And I don't know how do you think people would respond to that, to what the story, because the story I'm going to tell is it's a love story, but it's a love story, but it sort of tramples the boundaries of what a romance is. I'll tell it the way it is, but what do you think would happen?
So I will say that I'm on the other side of the fence, because, and that's why I was hoping Kelsey would have that opinion, because I don't need that story. I mean, like, it surprises me that so many people, and I know so many people must ask you that, because to me, when I see that question, I think, well, we know how it ended up. You know what I mean? Like, we know we've got enough that in the scenes, but we know how it has to end. So I am not as interested. Now, if it was written, would I read it? Absolutely. Like, of course I would read it, but it doesn't pique my interest the way that like some people want it. You know, I'm just like, I don't need that. I have all the things that I need. Although I imagine there's a lot more that I just, you know, didn't like necessarily, like I said, pique my interest. So I just don't think that hard about it. So yeah, I think that it is definitely an interesting thing. I also read a book recently by Erica Ridley that was a, you know, 0.5 novella for a new series of hers. And I went into it thinking that it was going to be a, you know, romance novella, and it absolutely wasn't. It was backstory. There was no romance in it. In fact, quick spoiler here for anybody. I'm going to be very vague, but a character in it passes away that you know in the first book has already passed away. And so I also knew going into that because I had read the first book, I thought, oh no, we're going to see this happen. You know, so it was very different and it was really well done and unexpected and obviously stayed with me. So I think that there is a space in romance for those sorts of things. It's just such an interesting question, like you said.
All right. I don't know how to, you know, I could take a poll, but it would never be a scientific poll, you know, like, but because I do get a lot of letters like that and people want to know that story. And I know that story. I actually, and I mapped out, it's an actually two-part story. It's what happens before. It's Isaiah and Isolde, and then later it's what happens, you know, that results in the spoiler that I'm not going to say, but that you already know. So
if you read the books, you know, guys.
Yeah.
So I will say that now that we have talked about it, I really want to read it.
So. See, exactly. You're just curious about that backstory. And I'm one of those people, I'm always a behind the scenes person. Like, I love doing theater, not just because I wanted to act on stage, but I love just knowing what went on behind the curtains. And like, yeah, I was so totally juicy. Happy being the person behind the curtains.
It's that kind of, yeah, it's juicy. That stuff is so interesting. And I think it makes the rest of the stories, when you sense it, when you're in the story, but you can sense what's behind it. I think that's what, like, a shadow gives dimension to, I mean, I think you can, it gives the story more depth and more resonance. But it's also because I know it's going to be very angsty and may or may not, it doesn't really have a happy ending. I just wanted to make sure that people really want that, because I know those are fairly intense when I write them, and they're fairly costly emotionally, you know, and in terms of time and stuff. So,
yeah, I think plenty of people would read it. I think it's just one of those ones that needs to be a caveat, in the sense that it's like, this is a 0.5. This isn't part of the main series.
Right.
But you're going to get a lot of good information here.
Right. Yeah. Don't read it first. If there were other stories in the series, yeah. Have you ever thought about what, because I get other people want stories for various other characters. Like, and I have lots of ideas for, like, I know what happens to people. So, like, Jack and it started with a scandal, and Violet's and Flint's daughter, Ruby, that's one.
Oh my gosh.
That would be a fun one, because it takes this into like 1830, 1840, I think. Yeah.
That'd be fun. Yeah. I'd read that.
Yes, yes, yes. But then, you know, Pennyroyal Green did finish in its date for now, as you said. And you've started with your new series, The Palace of Rogues. So when you started that, you know, did you want to do something different with Palace of Rogues and Pennyroyal? What was calling out to you to start that? In fact, one of our listeners also asked, so this may be kind of part of the same question, where did you get the idea for the Grand Palace of the Thames series? It's so unique and interesting.
I wanted, the answer is, has several parts. And one of it is, I like the idea, I love an idea of basing a story in female friendship, and especially unlikely female friendship, because in the Regency, so much of your entire destiny, if you were a woman, hinged on a man. And a man left these two women, who Angelique and Delilah, destitute. And this is something they have in common, despite the fact that, you know, besides the fact that they shared a particular man. But I like the idea of them working out those particular differences and finding compassion and connection in that difference and rising above and being Phoenix rising from the ashes. I always love those stories. So taking something that is very much what they call a sow's ear and turning it into a silk purse with the Grand Palace on the Thames, you know, they use their ingenuity, their strength, their resilience, their friendship, their kindness, all of those things to create a place that they wanted to reflect the kind of life they wanted to live. And they had both lived particularly not cloistered lives, but very lives that were defined very much and narrowed very much by the men in their lives. And they wanted more exposure to the people they actually liked and cared about and could be honest and real with. And so that leaves in a boarding house, you never know who's going to come through the front door. And so that gives them both agency. They own the place. They run the place. They make the rules. And also it allows them to create a sort of found family from the people they can choose who stays. And it becomes a refuge, both for me as a writer and readers. It's like to create this idea. I mean, it's not perfect. It's fairly chaotic in some ways, but it's, you know, it's fairly idealized, egalitarian place for people to stay. And it also, the setting it in a boarding house gave me an opportunity to have a lot of different kinds of characters come through the door. And that for me is delicious. Like who can I create now? What kind of conflict will that be? So the variety really, really appealed to me. And also the idea of mixing so many different people with the rules require them to sit in the sitting room at night and to socialize with each other. And that just presents so many fun opportunities for conflict and banter. And, you know, it's just, so all of those things I thought about, I'm like, who do I want to spend time with and what do I want to write and what's going to be just the most fun? And that was, that was the result.
Well, it is super fun. I love all of those little idiosyncrasies that they have in their boarding house, like the swear jar and the requirements and all the rules. They are very like fun and delightful as you read past them. It adds so much character to the setting, you know, and I think that it's really interesting because so much of it so far has taken place within the boarding house. Like, you know, you've been kind of within the four walls of the boarding house for a significant amount of the stories. And I think that that's just a really, it's a really interesting thing. And also it never feels confining either.
Interesting way to put it. Thank you. And I noticed that too. We get them outside of the boarding house in the book I just finished. It's a lot happens in some of it outside of it. But but I think when you're dealing with character and you really have stories that are character driven. Well, just think of like Friends. How often did they leave the apartment? You know, in Friends, you know, there's like, that's, if you tell your stories and you have your characters vivid enough and they, and you introduce new characters who can strike sparks off recurring characters and change the dynamic and also show the current characters growing and evolving. Like you'll see Dot and Delacorte grow and evolve as the series goes on. You don't notice that you're within the confines of a particular place. And also the different rooms in the place have their own character. You know, there's the reception room, which is one thing, you know, where you're judged. are you interviewed? Are you allowed to stay here? And then there's the sitting room where the entertainment takes place. There's the bedrooms. There's, you know, so each room has a different sort of character and feel and a different kind of scene that would actually take place in it. So I think,
And I think you've really captured that in it with the boarding house. I know for me, like I can really visualize it you know, a lot of times when I'm reading a book, even if they describe like what the house looks like, you know, if it's just they went into the entryway, then they had tea and then they left, you know, I don't really visualize that house very well versus like I, in my head, we were talking about it, and I instantly, in the first book where she's like cleaning the chandelier or something and she's stepping up. And like he was talking about the light playing and thinking she wasn't like the countess or whatever like that. Like I can still visualize that scene and how I think the house looks and how it's laid out. And, you know, I can literally see the light coming through the windows as she's trying to clean. So
see, that's wonderful. I love that.
And the house is its own character to me.
Right. And that's a, well, there's a couple things that you sort of hit upon there. That first, that I try to write cinematically in a way because I want to put myself in the scene. So mm-hmm. I want to show angles and I want to show lighting and I want to show, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like I want to set that scene, and mm-hmm. all of that contributes to the emotion of a scene. And also the details that I include should have an emotional connection to the characters. Like when you're describing a scene, like the chandelier is significant to them. It's they mm-hmm. toasted it with light. It was a symbol of hope. It was, it's something that they really prize and value, and it's emblematic of their success, their rise from the ashes. Same with the foyer, the marble foyer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like everything has a little bit of an emotional connection to the character. So the details you include should help contribute to the emotion of a scene or to the story, if that makes sense, the physical details. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you do that consciously, the reader will not know precisely what's going on, but will definitely pick up on it. We'll definitely experience it that way.
I think we have picked up on it. And I mean, it's definitely listening, Kelsey, to you talk about it. It was just like, oh yeah, I can see the staircase and I can see the entryway. You totally reminded me of my own envisioning of those settings. So I think at least two readers.
Well, like the worn out settees. Mm-hmm. And part of the fun part too is showing how the new guests experience it. You know, like they're like, huh, why is this place charming? Mm-hmm. None of the furniture matches. You know, it's like everyone has a different, mm-hmm. that's kind of fun to show it through everyone else's eyes because everyone's going to see it a little bit different. And likewise, the rules. Like some people are like, yeah, I like rules. These are good rules. And then there's like Lord Bolt who's like, forget these, you know, but I'm not me, follow rules. So it's another thing to, you know, bump up a source of conflict or whatever to show.
Well, speaking of this, we're building upon it. I'm envisioning the boarding house, which means I'm so excited for I'm Only Wicked With You.
Yay. I'm so glad you're excited.
So tell us a little bit more about it as much as you can.
Let's see. Well, we meet Hugh Cassidy appears in the last part of Lady Daring Takes a Lover. He's an enigmatic American that is a man charged with purpose, clearly, but he doesn't reveal much of himself. He's very much has a sense of restlessness and impermanence. That's how they experience him at first. And then we meet him a little more, we get to know him a little better. He's Mr. Delacorte's favorite friend. Delacorte and he get along better because they're both from backgrounds that are pretty basic. You know, they can enjoy mm-hmm. Pub songs and donkey races and those kinds of things, you know, because Hugh is very much, you know, his father was a bastard. He was born in a log cabin in New York and he's risen from absolutely nothing and he intends to have an empire. And so we get to know, have a sense of his sort of quiet strength, but and then by the third book, at the end of the epilogue of Angel in a Devil's Arms, Hugh encounters Lilius. And in that moment, everything he thinks he wants is called into question. You know, and it shakes the foundation of his world and his single-minded purpose for being there in London in the first place. So, and I'm only wicked with you, the ramifications of that encounter, they are, you know, they are, he tattles on her for because he caught her smoking a cheroot, and he tells her father, which endears him to her father, but not so much to Lilias. But there are reasons that Lilias has some things in common with Violet Redmond, I think, in that her family doesn't see her clearly. Once you're slotted into your family, you know, you have your role, and people have a hard time seeing beyond that. And also, she's suffering in a way that she doesn't want to inflict on her family. She's suffering kind of a secret heartbreak, and she knows that they will fuss over it. Mm-hmm. So she has a certain amount of pride associated with that, and also a certain amount of tenderness. She doesn't want anyone else to feel hurt on her behalf. So she is acting out. You know, she's, her world has begun to feel, and the way the ton has begun to see Lilias, who is a diamond of the first water, has become very confining to her. And she doesn't know how to put, how to define that necessarily. She doesn't even know that that's what's happening to her, but she does know that she craves things like galloping at a breakneck speed on a horse or climbing into the bell tower. You know, she's just, it chafes. And here is this wild brood that she would never, he's not wild, but he's just a very profoundly confident, working class man who through contrast, she begins to see another side of the world and another side of herself that's very troubling because it shakes up her sense of peace and also is exhilarating because she sees what could be. And so they both fight against that very, it's a struggle within, you know, it's they are not so much enemies of each other as of their own expectations and desires and what they want from life.
The exciting thing is that it is out now. Yeah. It came out just a couple days before we were recording this. So since that undoubtedly piqued your interest, listener, you should grab your copy now.
Well, it definitely piqued my interest. So
excellent.
I'll definitely be, I'm reading their other book for the podcast right now. So the fun reading's put on hold for podcast reading, which I'm enjoying. But then I'll be able to get lost in I'm Only Wicked With You.
Yeah, I had it on pre-order, so it's waiting for me when I finish my podcast reading also.
Hooray! And we do that. I'm so glad you guys are doing the podcast reading. Your takes are so interesting and so charming. It's really a delight to hear. So your sacrifices are not in vain.
Well, gosh.
Well, thank you so much for telling us that.
Yeah, because sometimes I don't know. Nobody asked for us to do this, to throw our opinions out there. But nonetheless, we have always forged ahead. So.
Hey, that's probably true of anybody who does anything creative. Like no one asked me, you know, like you're just like, here's a book, you know, I hope you like it. So, you know, that's a compulsion. So,
So then what's next for the Palace of Rogues? And like for you, is this going to be a big series? Is there big plans for it? I know there's a book coming out later this year.
There are two more books so far. After Dark with the Duke is out in November 30th. And actually, I think it is... It might be my favorite book so far that I've written, like ever. So it's a...
Oh my gosh.
So well, I will see.
We're excited now.
It's a bit... something about age differences, I think, I have a lot of fun with. And I loved writing these two characters.
Well, Zoe, that's like her new favorite trope over here.
Okay, well... So we read one where the heroine was 47 and the hero was 32. And I was just, I really liked that book. Not that I'm always about an older woman, but I think like when you can do an age gap trope, regardless of the split, well, I think that there's just something really compelling about that. I don't know.
No, it is. I think when you have... The beauty of it for me, especially when you're writing older heroes, I love the idea of an older heroine too, and I haven't really done that yet. Well, actually, I did that, but not much older. And I did that in a Notorious Countess Confesses. But is they are over it. You know, they know who they are. They don't tolerate, you know, the old, you know, they're confident. They know they don't need to prove anything. You know, and the fact that they're settled in their ways and can be shaken by an encounter with somebody new, somebody unexpected is kind of delicious too. And when they think they have nothing else to learn and maybe nothing else to expect from life and they're perfectly content and that proves to be 100% wrong, thanks to the, you know, who you pair them with. I think that's a delight to write. That's just really delicious.
Well, I think that's totally true. It's why I really like Genevieve's book.
It is. You know, despite an agent, what matters is who you are, you know, who you are at your essence. You know, it's not so much about the years that separate you, mm-hmm. but what do you value? Who do you value? How do you see the world? Those are the things that connect us, I think, mm-hmm. no matter your age. And
absolutely.
And then we have another book coming out in June of next year. And the title, we have a title, and it's You Were Made to Be Mine. So that's going to be another, that one's
great super, title.
Super angsty and really juicy.
Oh, I love a good angsty book.
So that was, it was intense. So that's it. I don't know. There may come, I don't know in terms of where the series goes, but there just seems to be endless possibilities. And so we'll see if readers respond to it and want more, then we'll do that. You know, because there are a lot of peripheral characters.
Awesome.
Too. You know, people ask about Robert, like Lucien's, brother, mm-hmm. who is going to be a Duke and all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So the inspiration is on simmer.
Love it. Well, we're really excited that we've got more Julie Ann Long books coming our way because we just can't get enough.
You're so sweet. Thank you so much. I so appreciate it. I really, really do. It's lovely. It's lovely.
Well, we would love to talk to you all day and ask you so many more questions, but we're going to wrap it up for now and let you go about your own day. And we are so grateful that you joined us also. It's just been a really wonderful thing for us to kind of come full circle and get to talk to you. And we just appreciate your support and your books and you.
Ah, thank you. You're going to make me blush. No, it's just the sweetest. Thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you so much for appreciating that. It means the world. And it means I can't even put into words what it means. So thank you.
Well, before we sign off, if our listeners want to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
Let's see. You can find me on Facebook at author Julianne Long. You can find me on Instagram at Julianne Long Author. I'm on Twitter at Julianne Long. And those are your best options for keeping on top of all the news, I think.
Awesome. And we will be sure to link to those in the show notes. And we'll have some other links from our conversation, maybe some books that were mentioned. Listeners, if you are interested in clicking on those. But Julie, thank you so much for joining us. This was so fun.
Yes, thank you so much. We've been wanting to for a long time, and we're glad we could finally work it out.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. And thank you for being so delightful.
Well, likewise. Wow, Kelsey, that was so much fun.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. And even with the internet struggles that we were going through, which I don't think you could tell because they actually weren't too bad. I really just loved chatting with her. She had such an interesting, God, she could just remember so many books and authors. I just am like astounded by her recall. And then we were talking about artists and she was like naming these artists and I'm like, I got to look this person up.
Yes, I did that too while we were doing that. I'm like, type. I was like, I just want to see, you know, examples of the painting while we're talking about it. But yeah, it was just, it was really interesting to, you know, hear her perspective on writing and the process. And it's just, it amazes me to think about being with a series for, you know, years and years and years, and then saying farewell or so long for now, as she kind of alluded to. So I was just really fascinated by everything she had to say about that. And also, hey, listeners, thank you so much for your awesome questions. I think we got to almost all of the questions that were asked. Some of you asked questions that were answered before they were asked. So that's why you maybe didn't hear your question get asked specifically. But yeah, thank you again so much to all of our listeners for your awesome questions as well.
Yeah, it was really great to hear your thoughts, and it also inspired us to have just some really good conversations.
And thank you again to Julia and Long for joining us. And again, if you want to find her, you can find her on Instagram, Twitter, and her website. We're going to link to those all in the show notes so that you can easily follow her and find her. And also Facebook. She's pretty active on Facebook. And do make sure you pick up a copy of her newest book, I'm Only Wicked With You. That came out on August 24th. So you're hearing this in September. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, go read it because there's another one coming out soon too.
And you heard what she said about it. It's like her favorite book that she's written so far. That's like, you never hear an author say favorite.
Yeah, no, this is great. I'm so excited. I got to read this one so I can be ready for November.
There will be a link in the show notes to pre-order. I don't know if listeners, you know how important pre-orders are to authors, but they are so important. So if you really want to show an author your support, one of the best ways you could do that is just by pre-ordering their books. So I will put a link to pre-order it in the show notes. And just if you know you're going to read it, buy it now and you're going to get it on the day it comes out anyway.
Yeah, hit that pre-order so we can all be on the same page. And if you want to know more about us or upcoming books, you can subscribe to our email list. You can find that email list on our website at romancepod.com. And you can find information about us, about the show, and anything else you'd like. You can also find us on social media at Instagram and Twitter at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, on Pinterest and Facebook / T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, and on YouTube by searching our name.
Yes. And so we're on to the book that we're reading next week. And the book that we're reading next week also came out on August 24th. So a lot of books to read this month of August. And Kelsey, what are we reading next week?
Next week, we are reading Sarah McLean's newest book, Bombshell.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I can't wait. Haven't read it yet myself. So as of recording this podcast, although...
Samesies.
So I've got two great new books to read, and I'm really excited about that.
Me too.
So listeners, thank you all so much for listening. And thank you once again to the incomparable Julianne Long. We are so thankful you joined us and we are so thankful for all of your books. So join us again next week as we read Bombshell by Sarah McLean.
And may all your ever afters end happily. Julie, you and I are actually within easy driving distance from each other. I live just south of San Francisco.
You do? So. Where are you? Or can you say?
I'm in San Mateo.
Oh. See, are you a Bay Area native?
I am. I grew up in the East Bay.
Okay, did you mention that before? Oh, yeah, so did I. Let's talk about Fremont. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, but okay. I grew up even further east. I grew up in Martinez.
Oh, well then. Yeah. I'm a Bay Area native. This is my, you know, full circle coming. I was away for a while and living near my family in Paradise. It's funny. There's a connection between everybody who lives in the Bay Area and the Northern California hills. Like everybody we know goes camping there and, you know, knows all the rivers and knows. So you probably do that too. Mm-hmm. You probably grew up.
Yeah. So I grew up in the East Bay and then I went to UC Davis and then I lived in the Sacramento yeah. area for a while. So, my uncle lived in Truckee. So, you know, we went camping in the Sierras.
My brother lived in Truckee. It's funny. It's like almost everybody I know knows somebody who lived in Chico or, you know, it's funny. Small world. Yeah. It's a huge state, but it's just so small.
It really is. That's interesting. It really is.
Yeah. So I like being back. I mean, it's so who knows where I'll end up, but you know, this is home. All my friends are here. My eye doctor is here. My hairstylist is here, you know, so all those things you never give up.
Yeah, it's totally the way that it is. When you move away, you still remain. You keep a few of those things in your original place, and you just
hairstylist.
See them when you come back.
How do you get a new? It's like you know.
Yeah,
it's like how do you abandon that?
Oh man, yeah. That's a really tricky one. Finding a good hairstylist is tricky.
I think that's why I used to have valets.
It's true. I bring that back.
I can just bring my lady's maid with me.
Yeah, I need a lady's maid for sure.